Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Antifada. This is Sean KB with a solo episode, but of course, I'm not going in alone today. I am with Beth Shirky, the author of a brand new book that I just had the pleasure to read out from Verso, Blue Collar Empire, The Untold Story of U.S. Labor's Global Anti-Communist Crusade. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
As always, thanks to Tim at Verso, who always sends us like a list of the new books. And we are nice, you know, we're lucky enough to be able to get our hands on them, our hot little hands on them. This one's really good. So right off the bat, folks who are listening to this episode, there will be a link in the show description if you want to go ahead and buy it. And I highly recommend you do. If for, you know, no other reason than that imperialism, U.S. imperialism and imperialism in general, obviously remains a very hot topic, a topical issue, especially with the wars going on in Eastern Europe and in the Middle East right now. And Jeff's book does a really good job of situating the working class and its institutions in their subordinated capacity as members of the empire into the broader history of U.S. labor, which is in many cases a very dire and frustrating and sad and maddening story, but one that truly needs to be told. So, Jeff, how did this book come together? Where did you get the idea to do it? And where did your research lead you? Tell us a little bit about it.
So it's sort of the culmination of my life, you know, in a way. When I was like in my 20s, I didn't really know what the hell who I was or what I was doing with my life. And I was interested in international relations and international development. I was in the Peace Corps in Turkmenistan for about a year. And then I actually quit after I realized that that was just sort of like a pawn in a geopolitical chess match type of thing. Mm. Which I probably should have known before, but it really hit home once I was there. And, studied international development. I had this idea that I was going to work for the United Nations and all this type of stuff. But along the way, I kind of became increasingly sort of radicalized. And I thought, well, the reason there's poverty in the world and in the United States is not because it's just some like technical problem that, if you just do X, Y, Z and it's all solved with a certain amount of, charity or just teach people how to save money or whatever.
Micro loans.
Exactly. I realized that was all kind of bullshit and that, and I started to, think about capitalism, think about class and got involved in some social movements, Occupy Wall Street and started organizing with SEIU on the campaign that eventually became the Fight for 15.
Oh, great.
In Chicago. And I had already done a master's degree in international development, and I felt like, well, that was a big mistake. But I had realized that I really liked higher ed and academia. So I decided to go back and do a master's in labor studies at the UMass Labor Center. Mm. And after that, I was like, I'm just going to go for a PhD now in history and try to combine these things of these interests in, international, everything to do with internationalism and imperialism, as well as labor history, which I became really interested in. And, having read some labor history books where they sort of just briefly mention, oh, by the way, the AFL-CIO was working with the CIA and was involved in all these coups. And then it just kind of moves on to the next thing. And I would read that and I would say, wait, what? Like, that's ridiculous. That's wild. So I wanted to know more. So for my PhD dissertation topic, I kind of started looking into this history, in particular with the AFL-CIO's international operations in Latin America during the 60s, specifically the American Institute for Free Labor Development. A lot of this stuff that I had studied and trained in about international development in particular was tied to some of these imperialistic interventions that the labor officialdom was involved in. So as I was doing the research and writing the dissertation, I, came across all kinds of other great articles and books on this subject from different time periods, focusing on specific countries, specific regions, you know, specific periods of time during the broader Cold War. And I thought it was really necessary for there to be just sort of like one book that kind of covers it all, at least in the Cold War period, kind of a broad survey to try to put together the scholarship that's already out there and sort of synthesize it a little bit and summarize it, as well as put in some of my own original research that I had been doing in some of the different Union archives and AFL-CIO archives. And that's basically how this book came together. I felt like, you know, seeing how there is this kind of, you know, re-energized labor movement, you know, I hesitate to say that it's rejuvenated because union density is still falling.
Yeah.
But there is a lot more interest and popularity and energy around the labor movement, especially among younger generations, and more class consciousness among yes. younger generations. And the fact that, yeah, imperialism is very much still with us. And, you know, although the old Cold War is, you know, over, I guess, or at least, you know, nominally speaking, there's kind of this new Cold War developing. So it felt like, you know, just an important and timely and urgent kind of book to write.
I think you're right about that. I think that whatever, by the fate of the stars or just your own efforts, probably a combination of both, you managed to pull together this scholarship, I think, at a perfect time. Because you're right that unions are more popular than they've ever been in the United States. And yet, as we always point out on this show, and you said yourself, union density remains stagnant or declining in most industries, certainly in the private sector. And so that mismatch right there is obviously a liability for those of us within organized labor or class conscious workers, but it's also an opportunity. And your book provides a great opportunity to see the way in which organized labor in the United States was suborned and subverted, and the leadership itself given the task of being the adjuncts of the American capitalist class in undermining and destroying militant working class self-organization across the world. So really important stuff that we're about to get into. But I would be remiss if I did not mention also that you are a professor at the SUNY Van Arsdale Center for Labor Studies. So you're working on the front lines with apprentice plumbers, apprentice electricians. Which other trades are involved in the program now?
It's primarily the electricians. We do have occasional partnerships with the plumbers and with the machinists. And we were recently working with some worker centers, Workers Justice Project, and ROC. But primarily, apprentices from IBEW Local 3. Van Arsdale, Harry Van Arsdale, was the business manager of Local 3 and here in New York City in the 50s, 60s, 70s. He was also the president of the New York City Central Labor Council. And he believed that there, you know, people in the trades and working people in general should have access to a college education. And as a part of the apprenticeship for IBEW Local 3, the apprentices have to, they're required to get at least an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree in labor studies through our program, and they graduate debt-free. So by the time they finish their apprenticeship and they become, you know, journey person electricians, they also have at least an associate or bachelor's in labor studies. So it's a really unique, really incredible program, and it's a privilege to be able to teach there and work with those students.
And as an alumnus of it, as a maybe the only person in all time to go from teaching labor history to apprentices to saying, fuck this, I'm going to become an apprentice, I obviously have a huge appreciation for the program. So thanks again for being here, and shout out to all my Van Arsdale people out there. So on the book, you begin the book with, I think, a very startling anecdote, right? There is a Ask Me activist who becomes president of the union. Jerry Wirth is his name. In 1964, ascending to the presidency, he discovers that a government agency, the CIA, has an office in their building on the fourth floor. What is it that Jerry finds, and how does it fit into the larger picture of your book?
Yeah, so Wirth, you know, is from New York, pretty progressive trade unionists of the time, and moves to the, after he gets narrowly elected president of AFSCME, this is the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, the big public sector, one of the big public sector unions. He moves to Washington, D.C., into the headquarters. And yeah, there's these guys in a so-called international relations department who are, these guys are like in suits and they're like speaking Spanish and he doesn't know who the hell they are. He starts making inquiries and finds out that the former president of the union, who he had, Wirth had defeated to become president, a guy named Arnold Zander, had an arrangement with the CIA going back to the 1950s, where they had this phony international relations department with these guys who worked. I'm still not clear. It's never been totally clear who they actually were, but they were involved in Latin America, trying to, especially, you know, after the Cuban Revolution of 1959, trying to sway the working class of different countries in Latin America and the trade unions of Latin America to be more pro-US, pro-Western, and to not go, you know, to not follow Castro and, you know, that kind of thing. And there had been a particularly troubling or, you know, disturbing intervention that these guys had been involved with just a couple of years before Wirth became the president of AFSCME in Guyana, in South America, which at that time in the early 60s was British Guyana. It was still a British colony. And the chief minister, Chetty Jagan, who was a leftist, had been elected, and he was going to see the country through to its planned transition to independence, to go from being British Guyana to the independent country of Guyana. But because he was a leftist, he was a Marxist, he wanted to nationalize the sugar industry. The Kennedy administration was like not going to tolerate him. They were worried that he was going to be another Fidel Castro, and that once British Guyana became independent, it would become another Cuba. So the CIA launched this whole campaign to destabilize and discredit, and actually the Kennedy administration lobbied the British to delay giving independence to Guyana by a couple of years so that they could have time to get rid of Chetty Jagan. And as part of this whole campaign against this guy, the AFSCME and the CIA, some other union, AFL-CIO affiliated unions, funded the political opposition in Guyana to stage a general strike in, I think it was 1962.
Now this is where all the anti-fada listeners and like people out there are like, hashtag general strike. Awesome. We love general strikes. That's working class self-organization across lines. They're fighting the man. They're doing it. They're going up against the state. Tell us about what this general strike was for.
Yeah. So it wasn't that, I mean, right. But yeah, that's the thing. Like, you hear general strike, and if you're on the left at all, that sounds pretty great. And, you know, usually it is, but in this case, it was a politically manufactured general strike, and it wasn't, you know, across all lines or all different, especially racial lines. In Guyana, it was mainly, and still is mainly, you know, Afro-Guyanese descended from African, from Africans, and then the Indo-Guyanese descended mm-hmm. from South Asian Indians.
Yeah.
And Jagan was, you know, Indo-Guyanese, and his political opposition was mostly the Afro-Guyanese leaders. So this general strike was also kind of served to stir up racial conflict in the country. Mm. And normally, you know, general strikes, when they do happen in different countries around the world, they maybe last for a day, maybe a few days, a week. And it's mainly like a political statement.
Yeah.
In this case, it lasted for almost 3 months.
And amazing that these workers had such a big strike fund to last 90 days in their general strike. Where
exactly.
did that come from?
All that money was coming from the CIA, and AFSCME and its so-called International Relations Department played the key role of funneling that money, of being like, hey, we're just fellow union guys from the U.S. supporting you in working class solidarity. But it was actually all just a front for the CIA operation. And this general strike did manage to greatly weaken Jagan's government. He ended up being voted out of office not long later. And it also, like I said, stirred up racial turmoil, violence, really ugly stuff. And then only after Jagan was out of the picture did Guyana become an independent country. But this is what AFSCME had been involved in, and it's, you know, part what I mentioned in the introduction when I talk about this is sort of the juxtaposition between that and what AFSCME was also doing in the 60s, especially after Jerry Wirth became the president. And I should say Wirth terminated this relationship with the CIA as soon as he found out about it, to his credit. And he was being pressured by the White House and the CIA to continue it, but he said no. But under Wirth's leadership, AFSCME was, you know, became pretty well known for being a major player in the civil rights movement and organizing previously unorganized and underrepresented in the labor movement, black workers in the public sector, and the famous 1968 Memphis sanitation workers strike, which was Martin Luther King Jr.'s last campaign. That's where he was assassinated during that campaign in Memphis. So people in the labor movement, people know about that. They know AFSCME did all these great things for racial justice. But AFSCME also has this history of stirring up racial turmoil and violence, and part of the, you know, working with the CIA to undermine a democratically elected leftist government in Guyana. And so how do we, you know, people in the labor movement, how do we kind of deal with this? How do we make sense of this this dual history of the labor movement doing a lot of good things in the 20th century, but also being part of a lot of really evil things?
Yeah, the historical irony that you tease out of that, I think is really, really incredible. And as an introduction, it's great. But I think maybe for listeners out there who are very jaded towards American power, certainly the hegemony of American capital, which while it is declining day by day, during the mid to late 20th century and early 21st century was of course huge. Well, of course they would say, like in the age of color revolutions and everything, and like the Cold War, the settler colonialist AFL-CIO becomes the AFL-CIA, which is kind of like one of the things, like the little smirking comments that new leftists would make about the AFL-CIO. But the great thing you do is then you back up and you show that in a weird geopolitical way, the anti-communism of the AFL-CIO coming out of the Second World War is really goes back to a previous period, goes back to the Civil War within the American working class around whether you would have an internationalist, socialist slash anarchist syndicalist working class movement of unionism, or whether you would have business unionism, American Federation of Labor, Gompersism. Because George Meany, who plays the huge role as the true villain in your book for a lot of reasons, is a staunch anti-communist before even getting the AFL involved with the CIA, before the CIA even exists. But it's exactly the lessons that these anti-communist union officials learn in beating back the communist threat within their own unions in the 19-teens, 20s, and certainly 30s and 40s that allows them to, in many cases, be more hawkish than the CIA and the State Department themselves. So talk a little bit about how the war within American labor in the early 20th century sort of sets the stage for this imperialistic unionism later on.
Yeah, like going back even to the late 19th century, you know, there was the labor movement really was started by radicals, you know, who were against, or they were, you know, living through this rapid industrialization, this growth of sort of modern industrial capitalism, and how it was totally upending their lives, their work lives, and everything else. And they were opposed to it and calling for the abolition of the wage system, like the Knights of Labor in the 1880s. And you mentioned like various labor anarchists of that period, and socialists, communists that came out of that. But they faced constant repression from the state, right? Like the Haymarket Affair with the Haymarket anarchists rounded up and executed. And some of the biggest strikes that we remember of the late 19th century, the Homestead Strike, the Pullman Strike, you know, just facing severe state repression. And kind of out of that, you had people like Samuel Gompers, cigar maker, you know, and other highly skilled craftsmen, you know, white male men of Northern European origin, English speaking, you know, sort of the more privileged strata of the working class in the United States. And they thought, you know, the only, even though some of them, like Gompers, were partial to socialism in their youth, started to think, well, you know, this isn't working. The only way forward for the labor movement, the only way to be, you know, quote unquote, pragmatic, is to just kind of accept that this is the system. It, you know, industrial capitalism is here to stay. This is what it is. It's not going to change. The best we can do is ask for a little bit more, you know, better pay, shorter hours, a seat at the table. And in trying to achieve that, and that's obviously what the AFL, you know, was the culmination of that and became the standard bearer of that kind of pure and simple trade unionism, yeah. business
Bread and
unionism.
Butter. Yeah.
To sort of, once they kind of locked into that and said, this is our brand of unionism, they kind of really had to defend it again, because socialism and radicals didn't like just go away or disappear. They were still present in the labor movement and still trying to pull things in a more anti-capitalist revolutionary direction. And once Gompers and the other AFL leaders kind of said, no, we're very much just part of the establishment, they had to really fight for the establishment and against radicals in the labor movement and kick them out of their own unions, and in the process become less democratic organizations, because union democracy allows for leftists to actually, you know, win in union elections.
So at least state their case and have their fellow rank and file either agree with them or disagree with them.
Right. And so, you know, that's an important thing. And then moving forward and throughout the early 20th century, there were continued to be these sort of battles within, like you said, sort of civil wars within the labor movement, and the more staunchly anti-communist union officials would invariably win by through undemocratic methods and just, you know, purging communist unionists or other leftist unionists from their ranks. They came to see themselves as the real experts in how to fight communism, and that they knew better than even the government. So going, when you finally get to the Cold War period, or the beginning of the Cold War, a lot of these AFL officials, you know, they're like, we've been fighting communists our whole lives. We know how they operate. We know who they are, how they work. You gotta, you know, we're the ones who know how to do this. The AFL was even encouraging the Cold War before it started. Like they were never happy about the alliance between the U.S. and Soviet Union during World War II. And in contrast, or at least slight contrast, was the CIO, you know, that started in the mid 1930s as a breakaway of the AFL. Much more tolerant of communists in its ranks and other leftists and radicals. Several CIO unions were led by communists or communist sympathizers. And there was a hope at the very end of World War II, before the Cold War really began, a hope among CIO officials that they could kind of continue this wartime alliance with the Soviet Union. That was what Franklin Roosevelt had envisioned before he died. And a lot of these CIO leaders, like Sidney Hillman, who was the, you know, one of the co-founders of the CIO and president of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, he was very close to FDR, and he also seems to have hoped to continue this alliance with the Soviet Union in the name of anti-fascism. You know, it's not like Hillman and a lot of these CIO guys or FDR were communists or pro-communist even, but they were anti-fascist first and foremost, and they didn't want to see a World War III happen. They wanted to build up the UN and, you know, these kind of these mechanisms of international cooperation to ensure there would never be another war. And they particularly, for the people in the CIO, wanted to do this at the level of the organized labor.
Yeah.
And working with trade union federations from the Soviet Union, from Britain, from France, from all the allied countries, and they formed in 1940
international bodies, essentially similar to the UN, like the ILO, which are attempting to kind of unite trade unions across the what becomes the Iron Curtain, from north to south, first world, second world, third world, right?
Exactly. And particular for the unions, because the ILO is kind of like unions and government and business all together. But for unions specifically, they founded the World Federation of Trade Unions, the WFTU, in 1945. But the AFL was like, we're totally against all of this stuff about internationalism and especially having any kind of alliance with any sort of communist organizations at all. And so while the CIO joined and helped found the World Federation of Trade Unions in 1945, the AFL boycotted it. The AFL was saying, we need a Cold War. We need to weed out all the communists out of the CIO. We need to break, you know, different foreign labor federations that had a strong communist presence. We need to break, you know, split those union federations, create counter rival factional anti-communist union federations. And you know, the AFL, within a few years, by the late 1940s, the AFL's anti-communists kind of got their way. The Cold War ended up going into full swing. CIO purged its communist unions. CIO broke from the World Federation of Trade Unions. And instead, the AFL helped lead the creation of this new anti-communist international labor body called the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions.
Free trade unions. This is an important project in your book, right? Because a lot of, like on the surface, a lot of what the Cold War looks like as it heats up, as you say, in the late 1940s, is a battle between, as you said, like internationally affiliated, relatively independent, sometimes Soviet-backed, but not always, union groups. And then this conception of the free and democratic union, which of course is the American model, to be imposed or cajoled or funded, of course, from the imperial center. But it's part of like a larger Cold War project, right, on the part of American planners, like the Dulleses of the world and the Brennans of the world. Where did non-governmental organizations fit into this Cold War project, and why were unions so important to the projects? In fact, you call the AFL and eventually AFL-CIO by the time 1955 comes, and their international bodies as roving pickets marching from country to country, expending incredible energy and resources to block revolutionary ideologies and militant class consciousness.
After World War II ended, the U.S., you know, the U.S. had already been an imperial country, certainly in Latin America, the Caribbean, and Asia. You know, with territorial conquests and occupations of, you know, Haiti and Nicaragua and all of that, that long predated World War II and the Cold War. But after World War II, the U.S. kind of became a new kind of empire, more, you know, what a lot of historians have called an informal empire, to try to reconstruct international capitalism that had kind of fallen apart between the two world wars and the Great Depression. And try to reconstruct international capitalism in a way that would be carefully managed by the U.S. Through the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, through the U.S. Treasury, through the dollar, you know, the gold standard. And and part of this new kind of informal empire, it meant that the U.S. government wasn't always going to just be exerting direct, you know, military control over other countries, although obviously that did happen a lot.
Yeah.
But that wasn't like necessarily the main modus operandi for this empire. It was more like working through informal means, and non-government subsidiaries like student organizations and publishing houses,
Congress and, for Cultural Freedom, or various
Congress for Cultural Freedom,
yeah, arts magazines in Paris, you know, very sophisticated anti-socialist realist publications, but then also of course, you know, the trade unions.
Yeah, because I mean, they saw the two main. They saw obviously world communism, the Soviet Union, as their main obstacle or main opponent in trying to maintain this international capitalist system, and the main traditional kind of groups that they would see as like going for communism would be like intellectuals, which is why they had the Congress of Cultural Freedom, to draw intellectuals and artists away from communism, and then workers, obviously, right, and unions. So that's why the AFL and then AFL-CIO became such a crucial partner for the U.S. government in enforcing this informal empire, because They wanted to make sure, organized workers through things like general strikes or other types of activity or just political action could really help fuel leftist political movements, not only communist movements, but other just sort of left-wing national, anti-imperial, kind of like the movement in Guyana that we were talking about, that Chetty Jagan was leading. He was not a communist, he was a Marxist, but he wasn't, like backed by the Soviet Union or anything like that. But working class movements could really help fuel and empower any kind of broader left-wing project in the world. So to make sure that that didn't happen, and to make sure that unions and the organized labor around the world was not going to disrupt, this international capitalist system that the U.S. was trying to manage, and instead try to basically, contain. You hear all the time about Cold War
Containment,
containment. This
yeah.
was a way of containing the working class by saying, okay, you can have unions. So in some ways, you can almost say by today's standards, it's not so bad, because even though they're imperialists, so like you can have a union and you can have collective bargaining, just as long as it's, the political, the ideologically the right kind of union that's sort
Right.
of pro US.
Pro
Whereas I
free
think maybe
market,
later.
pro class collaboration, pro seeing the state as like the guarantor and the neutral arbiter of like class peace, right? These are the sorts of unions that
Right.
are being put to the fore.
Yeah.
There's a lot of interesting stuff in this book, but one of the things I found fascinating was a lot of the Cold Warriors, such as they arise in the post-war period, are former or even current socialists, right? As much as this is a civil war within the world global working class, it's also a part and parcel of the split between communists and socialists after 1917, 18, 19, and of course too after the rise of Stalinism, when more and more Marxists or radicals are driven away from actually existing socialism, right? You have Dubinsky, right? Who he was a textile worker, a working president, right? There's a
Yeah,
lot of
ILG.
ILG. There's always a lot of letters in that. That one always gets me. And he was a considered himself like a Menshevik. And then you have a great villain in your piece, another great villain on top of Meanie, who's Jay Lovestone, who begins as a serious communist and a serious Marxist. Actually, he's a Bukharinite, and his break from Soviet communism is when he's expelled for upholding Bukharin's conceptions. This is before the purge and the murder of Bukharin by Stalin and his forces. But like, it's very interesting, and it shows how tough the choices were for people to make, because there are these like good-hearted socialists who are saying like, well, we need a different path, and to do that, we have to break with it, like the Soviet system. We have to like respect civil liberties such as they exist in the West, and this is the basis for building a sort of democratic socialism. And it does. You don't have to become Jay Lovestone in this, who becomes an anti-communist warrior and ultimately like a neoconservative hawk and opportunist and a rampant corrupt psychopath. But you can even be like a good thinking democratic socialist and end up in this like vast network of collaboration with the state, collaboration with empire, and ultimately anti-socialist activities in the end.
There's a lot of interesting characters in this book who go through these kind of political and ideological journeys. And the book, I should say, it covers all the period of roughly 1945 to 1995. So there's even then later in the book, sort of different generations of characters who similar go through similar journeys, but in different time periods, different contexts. I mean, someone like David Dubinsky. Social, part of the, back in Russia, he had been, as a teenager, a member of the Jewish Labor Bund, socialist, and sympathetic towards the Mensheviks, and then fled to the United States, facing, repression, and being, he was going to be sent to a gulag and escaped. He was like something like 15 years old or 16 years old, comes to the United States, joins the Socialist Party of America, when under the leadership of Eugene Debs at the time, and goes to work in the garment industry, rises through the ranks to become president of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. But yeah, became very anti-communist after the Bolshevik Revolution, and sort of the Socialist Party of America had been kind of, you know, torn apart after that, and he came down on the side of the more, you know, social democrats. During the course of the New Deal, Dubinsky sort of abandoned socialism, became more like a New Deal liberal. Mm. But then during World War II, he still had a lot of international contacts with socialists, social democrats in Europe, trying to, you know, help a lot of refugees escape from Europe, especially, you know, Jewish refugees escaping the Holocaust, and built up all these international contacts. So Dubinsky ended up being a really important player in this early Cold War period, where the AFL forged this partnership with the CIA and the State Department, with Dubinsky kind of as a main important figure there. And then, yeah, Jay Lovestone, a high-ranking communist in the U.S. in the 1920s, and then expelled from the party, gradually became an anti-communist. He kind of had his own communist opposition party going for a mm-hmm. while in the 30s. But he became really the chief international, you know, he became the head of the AFL-CIO's International Affairs Department.
Left communists are not going to be dodging the anti-communist allegations after this one. Sorry, guys. Go ahead.
But Lovestone ended up becoming like a CIA agent, you know, for much of his life, while running the AFL-CIO's International Affairs Department. And like you said, just a really, really villainous character,
really bad guy, very nefarious and ruthless and bloodthirsty, a bureaucratic infighter. And his works are still on the Marxist Internet Archive, if folks want to check it out. They do stop in 1938, though, because I looked. 1938, the MIA doesn't have much from him anymore.
That's when he kind of finally, became full-fledged anti-communist. But then you have other figures like the Reuther brothers, who are also really important. Walter and Victor Reuther in particular, who I have
in my book, when I'm reading about the Brazilian military dictatorship that the AFL is partly responsible for propping up. And Victor Reuther finds out about that, and he's like crestfallen because he's a socialist, and he had this conception of like free trade unions that would somehow be moving towards democratic socialism. So I have in my notes just the phrase, the passion of Victor Reuther. Like the passion of the Christ, this man is just being like buffeted by reality, beating him over the head. Talk a bit about the Reuther brothers.
You know, they also were, you know, came up in the Socialist Party. Their father was a big time socialist, a follower of Eugene Debs. They had actually, when they were kids, their father took them to see Debs when he was, when he was in prison in Georgia, because they were from West Virginia or something like that. And in the 30s, Walter and Victor, they had just started helping to build the UAW in Detroit, the United Auto Workers, and then they actually spent about 2 years in the Soviet Union working at a Soviet auto factory, the Gorky Auto Works outside Moscow, and they were writing these glowing reports back home, like, this is industrial proletarian democracy, so much better than the wage slavery we know back in Detroit. And then just a few years later, like, Walter in particular became like the chief anti-communist in the CIO, leading the charge and purging all communists from the UAW and from other CIO unions, raiding other CIO unions, because he was driven by a sort of political ambition. Mm-hmm. He wanted to rise to the top of the CIO, and then later he hoped to become president of the AFL-CIO after they merged. And part of his ambition was, you know, throw his former communist allies, not that he was ever communist himself, but he was sort of, you know, friendly towards them for a while.
And they were the most militant and aggressive organizers in many cases in the 1930s.
Yeah. So throwing them under the bus was sort of like his, kind of stepping over them on his path to power within the labor movement. Whereas Victor Reuther, Walter's brother, you know, kind of stayed more true to his socialist ideals and was more of an idealist, even though he was an anti-communist. He like you mentioned, was for a long time behind the scenes, kind of quietly complaining about the AFL-CIO's, you know, partnership with the CIA and all these interventions, like in places like Brazil, like you mentioned. And finally, during the Vietnam War that this all kind of broke open with, you know, Walter Reuther. By that point, Walter Reuther was probably the most popular and well-known labor leader in the country, even more than George Meany, although Meany
Telegenic,
was.
good looking, he wore nice suits. He was younger, so he wasn't like an old labor boss guy. He kind of was like the JFK sort of vibe at the time, right?
Exactly. Yeah, he was sort of like the JFK of the labor movement, whereas Meany was this, you know, bulky old guy, always with a big cigar in his mouth and sort of the stereotypical, you know, union boss guy.
I guess the
And
Lyndon Johnson of the labor movement.
yeah.
I
Well, and
don't know.
but the funny thing is that Walter Reuther was really close to the actual Lyndon Johnson as president, so he didn't want to criticize the war, which is true of a lot of people on, you know, a lot of liberals and sort of some people on the left, or social democrats anyway, at the time. They were really happy with what LBJ was doing domestically and didn't want to criticize him over the war, and because they feared it would split the New Deal coalition,
Yeah,
which it, you know, it
it
ultimately
did.
did.
Yeah.
And so they were right to be concerned about
But
that.
they were
But
defending the ongoing Great Society, which is, of course, like the great contradiction within LBJ's political policy basket, which is you've got like militarism and war abroad, Cold Warrior, but then you have these like good social democratic programs of like state intervention and subsidy and all that. And so it makes sense that a very ambitious person, and I feel like already by the 60s, the New Deal coalition is starting to fracture. It would make sense that a labor leader in this point would not want to bite the hand that feeds them.
And so he, you know, Walter Reuther was facing growing criticisms within his own union as the anti-war movement started to grow, and people were saying, "You are, you know," especially younger people, the younger generation, his own daughters, calling him out personally for not, you know, saying you're a person who has a lot of influence in this administration and in the, you know, in the country generally. You should speak out against the war. And he was, you know, really cautious about doing it. But it was Victor Reuther who started to really speak out against the war and then start telling reporters that the AFL-CIO had these ties to the CIA, which had been, you know, that people had talked, people on the left in the US had sort of talked about that. The Daily Worker had published articles talking about the AFL-CIA connection, but they were mostly ignored. But when Victor Reuther, a high-ranking labor official in the mainstream of the labor movement and the brother of Walter Reuther, started publicly speaking about this to reporters, it's kind of finally broke open and led to, for the first time, some kind of a debate within organized labor. And this is when the term AFL-CIA first started being used. And Walter Reuther eventually did, you know, he I mean, part of this conflict was also the fact that Meany and the other AFL-CIO leaders were totally behind the Vietnam War, 100%, and even active on the ground in South Vietnam, supporting the anti-communist Vietnamese Confederation of Labor, which I write about, you know, I write about in the book. But Walter Reuther pulled the UAW out of the AFL-CIO in this period in the late 60s, partly because of the disagreements over the war, disagreements over foreign policy, and the best way to go about doing anti-communism. You know, was it through working with the CIA and violent interventions, or was it more of these kinds of like hearts and minds, you know, development type of stuff? Even though you could argue it's all, you know, it's all imperialism at the end of the day. But
Who was it in the book? Because we still have like excellently a lot of podcasting left here. I do want to like go past, like go to the 70s and beyond, like kind of the narrative split in your book. But before we do that, help me recall who was the trade unionist that was working with the AFL and the CIA who called all the CIA dudes the Phys Kids?
Oh, well, that was Lovestone
Lovestone.
also.
All right.
He so he, another example of how he was kind of an asshole, because you know, the CIA, he was a full-fledged partner of the CIA eventually, you know, CIA agent, like I said, for much of his career, from the late 40s till his death, really, in the early 90s. There was this tension, especially in the early years of the partnership between the AFL and the CIA in the 1950s, where Lovestone was, he wanted to basically run the AFL's international operation all on his own, but he had to answer to the CIA because they were giving him money. They were funding this stuff, and the CIA wanted, you know, they wanted their accounting done. They wanted to know, like, how are you spending this money? What, you know, what, give us some reports of what's going on. And Lovestone was like, I don't want to have to answer to you, especially. And there was this tension, kind of interesting, between the CIA officials and the AFL officials that were sort of based on their class differences and ethnic differences.
That's like Catholic or urban ethnics are sitting down next to like WASPy white collar, like white shoe law firm types, which was like what the early CIA was, which I find, and I want to use this as a hinge point, like a really poignant and dark kind of insight in the book, right? Which is that you have these people who rise out of the industrial working class, and many of them out of construction, many of them who are part of like the urban, ethnic, white sort of Catholic milieu. And they end up thinking that they're going to have an independent power base, that they're going to be able to like use their persuasion and their powers across the globe. And then it quickly dawns on them that you can say neither Stalin nor Standard Oil, but ultimately the guy who's giving you your marching orders and certainly your funding is a guy who is a lawyer for Standard Oil, most likely, and a banana republic and things like that. So the idea that these are the people, and of course the Chamber of Commerce is involved in this too. You've got big capitalist foundations who are helping to fund these outreach efforts through the AFL and the AFL-CIO, and of course the CIA fronts that arise from that thing. But like, it's a very dark vision to imagine that these white shoe law firm types of the CIA are like convincing these working class people that like they have the working class's best interests in part. And maybe because they were so opportunistic and maybe so cynical, they could almost see, I think, what happens. But ultimately, this story doesn't work out great for the working class, for the AFL-CIO itself in the story, which is kind of as we transition into the second part of things, because it's like, it's through militarism, it's through the First World War and the no strike clauses and the inviting labor to the table with like the Wilson's National Economic Board. And then later on, of course, it's the no strike clauses and the subordinations of the Popular Front during the Second World War that allow this very opportunistic but genuine free trade union movement, this business union movement in the United States, to gain legitimacy and actually gain like the legal and political power to exist and represent tens of millions of American workers and create the quote unquote like American dream, the great middle class during the golden age of capitalism in the 50s and 60s and 70s. But of course, the great irony is that in allying themselves with these state forces, they're also allying themselves with a budding free trade regime across the world. They're allying themselves with white shoe law firm folks who represent finance capital and industrial capital. And ultimately, and you know, this is where I'm going to let you talk, ultimately, by the 1960s and 70s, when the profits necessary to keep the class truce start to erode, and as more and more people are finding out about this cozy relationship between the supposedly free and independent American trade union federations and the imperial state, that this bargain, this idea that some combination of industrial pluralism, as they called it, which is to say class collaboration, some combination of modernization theory, which says that every, you know, third world, as they would say, nation, and developing country, as we'd say right now, can follow the same path of development that the United States did, as long as you have a good partnership between labor and capital, and then with the state kind of technocratically interceding between them, creating like a strong basis for capitalist development, creating enough profits and productivity that the boat can lift, the rising tide can lift all boats and yada, yada, yada. Well, it doesn't work out that way, right? And talk a little bit about what happens in the 60s and 70s here. It's not just that the implication between labor and the state is revealed. It also starts, it is the literal breakup of the New Deal coalition, right?
Yeah, I mean, politically and socially speaking, the Vietnam War plays a big role in that, in exposing what the Cold War really was, what the role of the U.S. in the world, really was, exposing that to a lot of Americans and including working class people, and some of the divides that emerge within labor, within the civil rights movement and other movements as well. But then, going into the late 60s and into the 70s, the kind of breakdown of that, as I said before, at the end of World War II, the U.S. kind of built what was supposed to be this, well-managed, well-functioning international capitalist system that starts to break down in the late 60s, early 70s, with more, for the United States, facing more global competition in manufacturing from like West Germany and Japan after they've rebuilt after the war, declining profit rates, inflation and
breakdown of the Bretton Woods system, of course.
Right, the gold standard, or Nixon taking the gold standard away, and I was going to say something before, stagflation.
Yes, right?
And yeah. The oil crises, and all these kinds of things, and that led for American industrial corporations to realize that if they wanted to keep their profits up, they needed to screw over their workers. That was the best thing to do, the easiest thing to do. So, speed ups, automation, moving production to the South and the Southwest, which were still largely non-union, and that gets to another, you could go back to the Operation Dixie, how a lot of in the 40s, a lot of communists in the labor movement were really pushing for organizing the South, organizing African Americans, organizing Latinos in the Southwest. And that was all kind of abandoned when the communists were purged. Mm-hmm. And now fast forward a couple decades, the industrial companies were moving production to those areas, to those non-union areas, and then eventually moving into, the global South, moving into Latin America, the Caribbean, eventually Asia as well, outsourcing, offshoring, deindustrialization, all these things that really picked up in the 70s and continue, and then obviously into the 80s and beyond. And for the top leaders of the AFL-CIO, they didn't really have an answer to this. And in many cases, they just sort of, George Meany and then his successor, Lane Kirkland, who came in as AFL-CIO president in 1979, kind of just doubled down on sort of strategic wager of, we're going to be full partners of the state, especially when it comes to issues of foreign policy and showing how we're very loyal, and we hate the foreign enemies of the United States, mm-hmm. and we're strong anti-communists, just sort of doubling down on that because they didn't really know what the hell else to do. And this is why in the 70s and 80s, you start to see more and more rank and file rebellions, and rank and file, because the actual membership of a lot of these unions realize that we can't keep going, as business as usual. The whole global political economy is changing. We need a different approach. We need to be, whether that means being more militant or coming up with new political alliances or what have you. But a lot of the top leaders of the AFL-CIO, like Meany, was, well into his 80s by the time he retired. It sort of reminds me of a lot of the Democrats in Congress today who are just, you think, why don't they just retire and step aside? And it was sort of like that with a lot of the labor officials, just these same people.
They had beat back the Reds. They had made a historic bargain with the capital and the state. They were like the trusted stewards of an industrial system, like a system of labor management that was supposed to, after the NLRB and then Taft-Hartley was supposed to remain in place in perpetuity. This was like their version of the Keynesian end of history, you know? And of course, it doesn't work out that way, but it's not surprising that they would want to hold on to all this power. We have a lot more discussion to do. I want to go behind the paywall in just a little bit. But before that, and, you know, so people don't get like the wrong idea here, I'd like to shout out some of the heroes in your book. Right. Because you talk about this rank and file rebellion of the 60s and certainly in the 1970s. And a lot of that was rank and file wildcat strikes in like Youngstown, Ohio, and workers overthrowing the old union bosses that had been from this previous era. It's also workers more and more discovering and writing about this AFL-CIA connection and critiquing American imperialism, Detroit Revolutionary Union of Machinists, you know, doing like reviving Marxism, like in the union movement in Detroit. There's all these things happening, and you have some great heroes in your book. You have a woman named Maida Springer, who kind of goes against the remit. She's a Panamanian and Bahamian American worker, and she ends up trying to, in a good faith way, lead to a sort of more socialist decolonization in Africa in the 1950s and 60s. You have Leon Davis of Local 1199 SEIU, who I believe was the one that revealed, I'm showing the lack of my notes here. Fred Hirsch of the plumbers who revealed the Sandinistas?
The Chilean coup.
Chilean coup, yeah, the Allende coup. And Ed Asner of the Screen Actors Guild, who also came out against the Contras in the 1980s. So they're like, one of the lessons I think from this is that you have the possibility always for like internationalism, and you have if you have democratic unions, there is a potential and a possibility for like internationalist activists and socialist activists to rise in those ranks and make a real difference and within their own locals and unions and more broadly. It's just that this intransigent class collaborationist imperialist system had so much power and so much purchase up through the 1970s or so that like even the good activists couldn't break through until a certain period of time, and then it kind of feels like it's too late, right?
Yeah. Definitely, like the point of the book is not to say like the labor movement is just this hopeless lost cause, and that people on the left should just write it off because it's just imperialists. It's just the AFL-CIA and that's it. And just be kind of, it's not supposed to be an excuse for like inaction, you know, that the book or to just sort of, like I say, sweep aside, write off the labor movement. It's a kind of a contest for power within the labor movement itself about what kind of labor movement do we want to have. And obviously we, right now we need a bigger labor movement because it's small and union density, like we said, is like kind of stagnant or in decline. And so we hear all the time about we need to organize more and we need to get, you know, unionize the, you know, non-union industries. That's absolutely true. But we also have to talk about some of that. Sometimes we also have to talk about, not even sometimes, a lot of the times, confronting who are the leaders, who are the officials anyway, in charge of the unions and the AFL-CIO, and how do we reorient the labor movement in a different political direction? And so that's what was going on throughout the Cold War. You mentioned some great examples of various rank and filers or just sort of middle ranking union staff and local leaders pushing back against all of this Cold War anti-communist hysteria and partnership with the State Department and CIA, exposing some of these things, trying to educate the rank and file, trying to organize against imperialism. And that's sort of an important message. If, you know, this is primarily a history book, I'm not trying to make too many bold statements or anything. But if there is a bold statement, it's that we need a labor movement that's not only bigger, but it's also better. You know, yeah. Anti-imperialist internationalism is really a vital thing we should be focused on. And I think, you know, maybe I'm just generalizing, but in the labor movement today, that kind of discussion, that debate is not even there. And when you consider all this history that we've been talking about, it really needs to be there. So that was that's kind of why another reason why I wrote this book.
Well, once again, the link to purchase this book will be in the show description. I highly recommend it. Very good if you're in a union or you're not in a union and you want one. Really good educational material. And you and I are going to go behind the paywall now. If you're not a patron yet, patreon.com/theantifada. That link will be in there too. And we're going to tease out some of the stuff that maybe you couldn't say in a history book. You and I will talk about what some of the other options might have been in the past, the failures and possible successes, but also maybe tease out what might be a possible way to make right this horrific history that you discuss in this book, and you know, not make the same mistakes again. So Jeff, thank you so much. We'll see you on the other side. All right.
Thanks.
All right, and we're back. The towards the end of your book, we get into the post 1970s, like all is revealed, but you still have Lane Kirkland, who's, as you said earlier, the successor to George Meany, remaining naive about like what are the stakes, say, in Eastern Europe in supporting like the Solidarity movement in Poland, in making connections with trade unions of like the Eastern Bloc. What sort of possibility might there be for like free and open unionism in like let's say a post-Soviet region that's like some amalgamation of the Soviet Union and the United States. Of course, this is all dashed when shock treatment comes in, right? But like the 70s and 80s, I think, are a very kind of sad period here, right? Talk a little bit about what happens then.
Yeah, you know, I think for people like Lane Kirkland and George Meany before him, in the 70s and 80s, as you have all this dramatic political economic change, deindustrialization, and union membership already declining, they kind of blamed this on the new left and the breakdown and you know the breakup of the New Deal coalition that
if
happened.
It wasn't
the
for you meddling kids, right? Right?
Yeah, and so I think this is partly why they were just doubling down. They were trying to like say, let's get back to where we were in the 50s with this sort of close partnership with the American state, and you know, let's just go back to fighting commies together. And they kind of realized this in a way in the 1980s with the creation of the National Endowment for Democracy. Mm. Which Kirkland, as president of the AFL-CIO, played a big role in lobbying for that, lobbying the Reagan administration. And the National Endowment for Democracy is sort of this class collaborationism in practice as a partnership between both and between the Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO, as well as both the Democratic and Republican parties. So it's this sort of it's the worst of everything.
It's the worst of all worlds, bipartisan
and class collaborationist.
That's America, baby.
and the whole idea of the NED as it's created in the 80s is sort of like meant to be like an answer to the defeat in Vietnam, followed by detente in the 70s, to sort of say, no, we got to get back into this no holds barred contest against communism. We got to get, you know, bolder once again. And for the AFL-CIO, for Kirkland at least, I think he thought that maybe that's a path back to how things, this more stable kind of labor relations and economic prosperity, at least for the more, you know, the more sort of privileged strata of the working class. Mm. And so that's right at the same time as, you know, yeah, the Solidarity movement in Poland And there's so the NED with the AFL-CIO playing a prominent role, it funnels a lot of money to Solidarity as well as the CIA does as well. And the idea is like, yeah, let's take on communism within the Soviet bloc itself. And they're, you know, of course they end up being pretty successful there. 1989, the elections in Poland and Solidarity wins and takes over the government, and that's followed quickly by the fall of the Berlin Wall and so on and so forth. And before you know it, the Soviet Union itself dissolves, the Cold War is over. But once again, it doesn't lead to anything good for the working class, right, neither in the U.S. nor in Poland or the former Soviet Union. Yeah. Because like you say, you have shock therapy. And as you were talking about earlier, about how this is all premised on these partnerships between workers and worker organizations on the one hand, and partnering with like Wall Street law firms and these, you know, Ivy League educated, government officials,
and the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation, the Pew Charitable Trust and all that stuff. Yeah.
Right. All these forces that couldn't wait to decimate organized labor, as soon as they, you know, as soon as the time was right. And
Lane Kirkland allying with the Reagan administration and forming the NED to get what you call the CIA orphans, to try to get them funding to spread free unions and like workers' rights and liberties across the globe, as of course Reagan is shit-canning the PATCO air traffic controllers. Yeah. And kind of signaling to big business in this country through the 1980s that it's open season and that the class compromise is dead. So really just very hidebound and sad. And it must also be a high degree of cynicism too, right? Because you've got officialdom with their cynosures, and they've got their cars and their gas card, and they've got their nice offices, and mm-hmm. it's not them, of course, who's losing jobs in the Rust Belt or seeing their standard of living declining. It's just the rest of us.
Absolutely, yeah. These people like Kirkland, just totally detached from the workers that they were supposed to be representing. Kirkland himself, another interesting character who graduated from Georgetown School of Foreign Study or School of Foreign Service, where a lot of like, you know, diplomats go to get their education. You know, kind of an interesting pedigree for a AFL-CIO president. Yeah. And one of his closest personal friends was Henry Kissinger.
Not the type of people we unionists tend to, you know, rub shoulders with typically. Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, this is why, and I, you know, write about it in the book. In the 80s, there was really kind of the strongest yet pushback from not only from the rank and file, but even from many union presidents within the AFL-CIO, pushing back against Kirkland, against this AFL-CIO foreign policy, this partnership with Reagan, not only on Poland, but especially against, you know, with the counterinsurgency wars in Central America, yeah. Reagan backing the Contras, backing the Salvadoran government.
Apartheid, too.
But yeah, you know, this kind of bullshit constructive engagement policy, which, you know, really rings a lot of bells today. Like, you know, no, divesting is bad. We need to have more. We need to keep supporting, even though we recognize the horrible human rights abuses. We need to just give them more support. You know, that's kind of what we hear about Israel today. That was what Reagan and his administration was saying about South Africa in the 80s. And so within the ranks of the labor movement within the AFL-CIO, from the rank and file level all the way to the, you know, several union presidents, were pushing back against all of this. And
the National Labor Committee, right, for emergency relief.
Yeah, it's the longest name possible. National Labor Committee in Support of Democracy and Human Rights in El Salvador.
All right, there you go.
Otherwise,
NLC is good enough
NLC,
for me.
Yeah. And what's interesting about the NLC, so this was a group of several union presidents who were, you know, opposed to Reagan's support for these counterinsurgency wars in Central America. And opposing, you know, challenging Kirkland and the other AFL-CIO's top officials on these international issues. And the NLC ends up in the, after the Cold War, after the civil wars in Central America were over, the NLC kind of transitions into being this anti-sweatshop watchdog group, you know, in the 90s, led by Charlie Kernahan, who famously made Kathy Lee Gifford cry on, you know, by exposing how her brand, her own brand of clothing, you know, that was being sold in Walmart, was being produced by sweatshop workers.
I remember that one, yeah, and the anti-Nike campaign and all that stuff. I remember it well.
Yeah, and so that this, you know, it's what became this anti-sweatshop movement in the 90s and early 2000s started as this sort of labor solidarity with Central American workers, including leftist, Marxist-Leninist trade unionists in Central America who were facing violent repression. So it's pretty, you know, that's a somewhat more positive, I guess, development that this starts to happen. And then not long after, and by 1995, Kirkland is basically pushed out, and these other traditional, you know, rabid anti-communists within the AFL-CIO's International Affairs Department are all fired and kicked out in the 90s when new leadership comes in. You know, it's not a full-fledged, like, revolution in the AFL-CIO. Some would call it more just like a palace coup. But you have, you know, John Sweeney, the president of SEIU, and Richard Trumka, president of the United Mine Workers. These were much more, compared to people like Kirkland and Meany, much more progressive, at least, you know, more liberal, and more focused on organizing here at home, recognizing the threats that were, you know, how the labor movement was under real threat, and wanting to do something about it instead of just constantly pouring so much time and energy and resources into fighting this anti-communist crusade around the world.
Yeah. I mean, it's part, like, it's incredible, and it's almost kind of flattering to see how much effort, how much energy, how much resources, how much skullduggery it took in order to weaken and disorganize the global working class through the course of the 20th century. I mean, that's kind of one of the broader pictures of this book, right? Is that the American ruling class, the global ruling class, realizes that without the subordination of labor, that there's something, there's this power over production, this power within society, that the working class has to, through like immense funds and like whole teams of people and all sorts of dirty tricks, all sorts of like foundations and foundation money. This is all necessary to ensure that this is an impotent class, that this class cannot organize itself, that this class cannot push for its own interests. And so in a way, that's kind of flattering, I suppose. Yeah. And you kind of see an alternate history that might have arisen by the time the union activists in the 70s and 80s, they realized these things, and the rank and files fighting back, like you said, great, like mid-ranking, mid-tier union activists, local presidents are starting to fight, and they're bringing up really good critiques of where the AFL-CIO has gone and its implication with U.S. power. But again, by that point, it's too late. And so we're left in the post-Cold War period, and your book kind of tails off there for obvious reasons. It's a book about the AFL-CIA. But like now we're left in a whole other situation. And I, on this show, and many of the guests that come on the show, and Andy and others, we're constantly trying to take the history of the 20th century and turn it into something usable. Sometimes that means having to go back to the 19th century, which I think is actually kind of productive, because this regime of class collaboration that becomes an imperial regime, and all the foundations that are formed, and like fake civil society groups and kind of fake ersatz trade unions, it's all sort of like an ersatz civil society, and like an ersatz politics that's imposed not only on the working class in this country, but then across the globe. And I don't have Rhodes colored glasses on, obviously, right? We're in a very dire spot right now as a species on this globe, but like, I don't know, I feel like maybe that has run its course. Let's certainly say that like the U.S. empire and its methods and means of controlling the global working class has lessened to a great degree over the last 10, 15, 20 years or so. I just wonder what, like, if we can step back, what would we imagine like a new internationalism looking like? Like, are the institutions in your mind, the institutions we have right now, the AFL-CIO, Unite Here, independent unions in this country, are these equipped for like a new internationalism? Are there the forces that exist for a new working class socialism to arise out of this milieu? Is it something that has to happen outside of that? Is it even possible to have a socialist movement without like a broad mass working class movement for it? What are your thoughts on this in the 21st century?
Well, I should first say that, you know, some of this stuff with the AFL-CIO itself, you know, does continue in the form of the Solidarity Center, which, you know, I mentioned briefly in the conclusion. The new leadership took over the AFL-CIO in the mid-90s, and they got rid of all the old line anti-communists. They took the various like anti-communist foreign arms of the AFL-CIO, these, you know, more acronyms, so I won't spell them all out. They basically consolidated them all into one entity called the Solidarity Center, which is still almost totally funded by the U.S. government, by the NED, by the State Department, by a U.S. Agency for International Development. It's active in over 60 countries. We don't know exactly what all it's doing. I mean, a lot of it is sort of NGO type stuff, education, and and I think stuff that is, you know, on the surface anyway, pretty, you know, benign and helping empower workers and worker centers and stuff like that. But it has also been implicated in, you know, the like anti-Chavez meddling in Venezuela, and now against Maduro, and involved in, you know, Ukraine and the Maidan coup in the 2010s. And it's been implicated in some of these, you know, ongoing U.S. imperial endeavors as in the Middle East during the time of the Iraq War, and things like that. And I think, at least for union members, like, it's really important to begin to like talk more about the Solidarity Center and what it's doing and try to understand it more, and talk about, because to get to your actual question, you know, what is a kind of real working class internationalism or, you know, kind of socialist anti-imperialism look like? If the AFL-CIO is the main, you know, body of organized labor in the United States, which the United States being sort of, you know, the belly of the beast of the global empire, global capitalism, if the main labor federation is still like a full-fledged partner of the U.S. government, you know, in the form of the Solidarity Center, and its international activities are all funded by the State Department, and that pretty much kills it right there. You know, any hope right there is, you know, so there has to be, I have my views that, you know, I don't think it's Solidarity Center wants to do actual solidarity. That's great, but it shouldn't be financially dependent on the U.S. government. Yeah. First and foremost,
maybe a red Solidarity Center. We got to get a red Solidarity Center going. I mean, since unions don't control that shit, I guess it'd have to be destroyed and something built on its ruins.
Yeah. But yeah, there are so many actual existing like institutions for there's the World Federation of Trade Unions that I mentioned still exists. It's headquartered in Athens, and it's still like the international body of the communist aligned trade unions around the world. And then there's the International Trade Union Confederation, which is sort of the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, the anti-communist thing that was founded by the AFL at the beginning of the Cold War. It has undergone some changes and has a different name now, International Trade Union Confederation. That the AFL-CIO was part of that. That's headquartered in Brussels. And the two, I think the International Trade Union Confederation has slightly more, you know, workers or union, more members, you know, more unions with members than the World Federation of Trade Unions. But there's still this divide. It's like the legacy of this Cold War divide, where you have two main international trade union organizations, but they're rival. They're sort of ideologically rivaling each other. They're not united. They don't, as far as I know, they don't really work together at all. And then there are the global union federations, the GUFs, as they're called, which like Industrial and some of these other ones, I'm forgetting the names right now, but these were some of the same groups that had also been funded by the CIA back in the 50s and 60s. They, at that time, they had a different name. They were called International Trade Secretariats, but they do a lot of work around like specific industries and trying to bring unions from those industries together and to sort of, you know, have best practices and, you know, raise standards across whole industries internationally. And then within like global supply chains, there are various, you know, like we were talking about anti-sweatshop types of organizations and different types of safety agreements and all this stuff. And then there's obviously the ILO, which is part of the UN. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of like institutional infrastructure there already. But like none of it, it's all at the level of like, you know, union bureaucracy, rank and file workers are not very much involved in this or connected to this. So there should be some, you know, within where unions already exist in the U.S., where people already have unions, I think a lot more education about those kinds of institutions and using, you know, the technology we have now of like Zoom and translation and stuff to actually be able to have worker, you know, rank and file workers be able to talk to each other a lot more face to face and organize together. But the other thing though is that there's like roughly 90% of the U.S. working class is non-union.
Yeah.
And so there's, and while that's, you know, bad, a challenge, it's also an opportunity in a sense that if the more organizing that can happen, there's a chance to create, like you were saying before with the Solidarity Center, something new, something different.
Well, let me, I think that's all. The international infrastructure shit is super important. And it's good to like, for people to recognize that like, they're kind of zombies, but they still exist out there. And like you said, they're captured by either like the UN or by various states or by union bureaucracy or whatever, but they do exist. Mm-hmm. So that's something for all of us to look into and think about. If I can pitch you, we have begun about 6 months ago, something called the Independent Labor Club of North America. We have branches now in New York, New Jersey, Chicago, Pacific Northwest, and Arizona, and also a kind of an orphan branch out in Melbourne, Australia. But basically the idea is to try to forge like a new foundation for like autonomous working class self-activity, to break with the sort of popular front model, which the Democratic Party is always trying to attempt to get us to buy in with their various different policies and projects. And it's this idea that like against the sort of ersatz civil society that's created really in the Cold War, created in the 20th century as a way to undermine working class self-organization. The ILC is like, it's not a political body and it's also not a union. It's like a third thing. It's like attempting to try to create the political preconditions, the pre-political conditions necessary for there even to be like working class autonomy, autonomous from the unions and autonomous from the state. So we're trying in our small way with various activists across the country and hopefully the globe soon to try to answer these tough questions. And we're not like even posing answers at this point in time, like take over the, like make a red ILO or take over the international confederations. Instead, kind of starting from first principles and saying like, what is it that the working class, what's class composition nowadays? What would like a civil social organization, like a club look like that was inclusive of like the broad American working class or the global working class? And how can we like invigorate a sort of older conception of what socialism is, which is not like a basket of policies or tax proposals or even workers' rights per se, but instead the conception of like the working class taking responsibility over society. And in the course of doing that, necessarily tending towards abolishing itself, you know. And that's all very highfalutin, but that's the kind of, and I think that this episode will be really good for that because like this is a, like what the history you give us is good for is showing the real way in which like working class self-organization was suborned, which implies ways to get out of that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that sounds like a really awesome and important organizing effort. And yeah, I mean, it's like I say, I struggle to come up with answers, unfortunately. But I think, and I say this as a teacher, you know, that education and is really an important place to start, and discussions and getting working class people together to talk about what internationalism is, why it matters, what imperialism is, and why that matters. And because those discussions, I don't think happen enough among workers. Yeah. When we get together as workers and talk about, usually through unions, we're talking more about those bread and butter kind of day-to-day issues, which of course absolutely matter, but they're also affected by all of these bigger global developments and the role that our own unions have historically played in all of that. So just having more knowledge, discussion, and education around all of this is the only thing I can say about where to start. And
I mean, you're in a good position to affect that. I'm thinking of your work with Local 3 IBEW, and obviously know plenty of IBEW electricians. I believe that the electricians were the first ones out of the gate to endorse Joe Biden. And I believe that, well, of course, now it's Harris, right? But like, there was a lot of consternation about that, because I think that the IBEW was also one of the unions whose ability to strike was undermined by Biden in Congress during the railroad strike period, right? So have you had any conversations in this vein, or like, what are your students, what are the apprentices saying right now are like issues with the labor movement? Are they seeing beyond like the steady degradation of our work day in and day out and the rise of non-union? Like, what are the broader conversations you're having with them?
I mean, a lot of them, as apprentices, and many of them first year apprentices, they're just kind of discovering what the labor movement is. They kind of go towards Local 3, they go towards the trades because they're looking for control, a good career, solid benefits. And the idea of being part of a union is sort of not foremost on their minds. And so that's what's great about our program and the classes they take, is that we're talking about labor studies. We're talking about what the labor movement is, what its principles are, what its its history, all the good things it's done, but also some of the shortcomings. And so they're sort of discovering these things. And there's obviously an election going on right now.
Oh yeah, there is. whether we like it or not.
Whether we like it or not, and it's so those conversations about the election come up, and it's important. There are people who support Trump, right? And there's people who support Harris, and there's people who hate them all. And what's I think important about the classes that we teach, and about Local 3 in general and other unions, is that it can be a space where working class people can actually talk about these things face to face, and not be talking over each other, not be in their own bubbles of whatever media that they're listening to,
not but just actually having some bullshit conversation in the shandy, like grabbing a cup of coffee in between running, like bending pipe or whatever.
Yeah, and some of them have said that they wish that union leadership would allow a little bit more space for those kinds of conversations, instead of just saying vote for this person, vote for that person, get out and vote, to actually say here's why and I think that's important, because especially when it comes to a lot of Trump supporters, it's not enough obviously to just say, oh, you're wrong, and Trump sucks, especially because then what's the answer? Vote for Kamala Harris.
Right. that's a tough sell for most people. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, or even Biden, before that. So, it's,
I'm firmly on team, fuck all of them. And I feel like at least in my gang and the people that I speak with, it's either fuck all of them or fuck all of them. Okay. Trump. you know, and then there's some Trump diehards, you know, because the Trump vote is kind of a fuck all of them vote too.
Yeah.
I mean, not in real life, but in people's heads.
Yeah.
And I get that to an extent. You know, I'm doing a little bit of service right here, maybe like a little quote unquote organizing. Have you heard of the Caucus of Rank and File Electrical Workers?
Yeah, but I don't know. I've heard of it, but I don't know a lot about it.
Oh, I'm going to send you a link. I'm actually, you know, one of the good, union activist socialists, that I've been fortunate enough to know. I just sent you a link in the chat and I can put it in the show notes too, is starting this campaign, and it's around union democracy, and it's around empowering the rank and file. And there's plenty of good socialists in it. And I think the IBEW, one of the early signatories, and the operating engineers too, also signatories in the 80s to the NLC, which I thought was really, really impressive. Like, I feel like these reform movements, people have been trying to do this going back to the 1920s and 30s, but I still feel like there is something real and alive in groups like CRU and others, and the movement of radical educator, or what's the one in the UFT here in the city?
Is it movement of rank and file educators?
Yeah, that sounds right.
I think so.
Yeah, groups like this, I think, are still super important. Like, before I started the ILC some months ago, and then found a bunch of people who I now really happy to work with all the time, really smart, good people inside unions and out, I was like, all right, what do you do, like, after kind of like millennial socialism has died? And, you know, one option is always just to like get into the union bureaucracy and like fight your way through the delegate structure, maybe become like a treasurer or something like that. And I've never been one to say that like that isn't a good path for people who want change. I think fundamentally for me, and why our efforts have been outside of that structure necessarily, is that it's also zombie nowadays, and it's also ersatz, and we live under a labor relations regime, which of course those in power continue to enjoy its failures day in and day out, and do nothing to change it around, with card check obviously under Obama and all the various promises. So like, what are you pessimistic about the Taft-Hartley NLRB regime? Do you feel like there's a way to work out outside of that? You've had contact with like the Deliveristas and presumably people like Amazonians United, groups of that sort, worker centers obviously too. Like, where do you see a good place for the younger people like listening, or the people who are really mad and exercised and want to do something? What's a good place for them to go right now?
Any of those, like, some of the, there are these, I mean, you know, one place, why am I blanking all of a sudden? I know what it is.
The laundry center?
No.
Van Arsdale Center.
School of Van,
the Murphy Institute.
No, it's not. Sorry, hold on.
I'm just naming off. I'm like firing off all of the.
Ewok is what I'm thinking.
Ewok,
of,
yeah.
Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, which is if you're in a workplace and you want to start organizing your coworkers, whether that means going through the NLRB process to form a union, or having what sometimes people might call a pre-majority union, mm-hmm. where, like, you know, more like the Amazonians at Amazon, where you deliberately are not, at least not immediately seeking and, you know, going through the NLRB process, but just wanting to organize to start exerting some collective power around specific demands. EWOC, Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, has resources, it has trainings, there's organizers who you can connect with, and it's all like volunteer run. It's this sort of distributed organizing model, but it's a good place to start, I guess, for a lot of people, especially like organizing in your own, because I know people might think, well, maybe I should get involved in this or that organization, or this, you know, this type of political movement or whatever, and that's all fine, I'm not against that, but, you know, organizing in your own workplace is good for in and of itself because of the improvements you can make on the job, but also the experience you get from that, the, you know, being able to organize and talk to your coworkers and go through the actual motions, especially if you've never organized before or have very little, you know, to actually see how it works. Obviously, there's risks involved. You know, you could get fired, even though it's, you know, technically illegal, et cetera, et cetera. So, but at least learning a little bit about the process. So, yeah, Ewok is one place. All the other things you mentioned up are also also great.
The Southern Workers Assemblies is doing good work. I think they're affiliated partially with the crew, with the IBEW group. There's a lot of good places. There's labor notes, obviously. There's
labor notes. There's the Rank and File Project, which is, you know, if people want to get a job in some particular industry that where there are unions and become a union member and start organizing from within, the Rank and File Project supports that kind of work. And yeah, like you said, labor notes, and there's labor notes constantly has like troublemaker schools, both online, you know, workshops, trainings online and in person. And then every 2 years, the big labor notes conference in Chicago, which, if you're in the labor movement, you really have to go to that, and register early because it fills up.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's so many things, or so many opportunities, I guess. And it is, I mean, I am cynical about, especially looking at this election, you know, I think if the PRO Act had been passed, or if, you know, some way it could still be passed, and, you know, dramatically change labor law, that would definitely be a very good thing and very helpful. But what also has to happen is the established unions and the AFL-CIO have to devote way more resources to organizing. Yeah. They, you know, some research has shown, Chris Bonner, labor researcher, has shown that these unions have billions of dollars in their treasuries, and they're just kind of sitting on them, this kind of like fortress unionism. Yeah. Just
fortress
sort of
unionism, yeah.
And they're just sort of like waiting for when labor law reform maybe happens, then they'll spend the money on organizing. And they really can't wait, especially because in the last few years we've seen this uptick in militancy and class consciousness in unions being popular. And I don't know if that's going to last forever.
Certainly not if no headway can be made and there's no like political expression of it or no like social expression of it. Like I think one of the lessons from the past, from certainly the 19th and into the 20th century, is like, if you want, the only legal strike is one you lose, right? Like creating facts on the ground, I think, has been the way that we have won in the past. Even reforms, you know, is by creating a working class movement that's disruptive, impossible to ignore. And like the hidebound nature of the AFL-CIO in its decline, you know, the only way you could imagine them stepping up and utilizing any of those resources, even for like reformist moves, would be to force them, just to force their hand, because they're not all George Meanies, but they are all like, not all, but many of them are like Cornell labor management graduates. And a lot of them maybe were in the rank and file 20, 30 years ago, but have been wearing suits for several decades now. Mm-hmm. Right. And of course there's the institutional inertia that comes with knowing that one illegal strike, one wildcat, one sympathy strike, one secondary boycott could mean an end to the entire affair. Like you can be put under trusteeship, you could be decertified, and your union could go away. There's a lot of things that people outside of that apparatus can do to force the hand of people that are inside that apparatus. And I think that, like, if we're going to get anywhere, that's the direction that we're going to have to go.
Yeah. And, you know, when you look at the success of the CIO era in the late 30s, early 40s, and rapidly unionizing millions and millions of workers and entire industry, the biggest corporations in the country and on the planet at the time, unionizing them wall to wall in just a matter of a few years, it was kind of this combination of the people on the ground, a lot of them, you know, radicals, starting kind of, you know, creating the conditions to say you have to pressure not only the government to pass, you know, the National Labor Relations Act and so on, but pressuring union officials to form the CIO, to break, right, you know, to break away from the AFL, you know, and they were pressuring the AFL to take action. The AFL wouldn't move, so they just broke away and formed the CIO. And it was they put the resources into this organizing. So you had the on the ground, real dedicated workplace, class conscious organizers doing the real work. But they had the infrastructure and that, you know, the resources from the unions that were part of the initial unions of the CIO that broke away from the AFL. Yeah. So, yeah, you need.
That's what I always say to people who are like completely blackpilled on things. It's like, so you point out like the heroic example of the CIO for all its failures, ultimately. Mm-hmm. Right. But like it was largely like AFL affiliates and the radicals within that who learned the ropes, who learned the struggle on the ground and who learned how the AFL worked, saw and had criticisms of that, but were able to utilize that to break free and create something new and something that, of course, we know what happens, right? It gets implicated with everything we've been talking about here. But for a bright, shiny moment in the 1930s and even into the 1940s, I mean, if you're a communist or you're a socialist, where else would you have been except within these huge, great organizing drives reaching millions upon millions of workers? So like, that's why I always, despite my radicalism, you know, I've always said that we need to understand these as deformed, sure, but workers' organizations, right? That doesn't mean we accept them as they are, but we have to fight within them because these are the tools that we have at this moment. So I'm not sure you would disagree with me on that point.
No, I think that's right. And, you know, because we hear a lot from very, you know, intelligent, well-meaning and well-experienced organizers saying, you know, you don't like the way unions are, you got to just union organize and educate, organize, organize. And that's true. But part of that means confronting the union officials who are in charge, calling them out, not just accepting, oh, you're the president of the union, so I got to support everything you say and do. And then the other part of that, like I mentioned earlier, that the 90% of non-union workers. So even if you don't want to work within the existing unions, there's plenty of space for new unions. I mean, I think there's still to some extent, you know, like I said, with the resources and support of the established labor movement is going to be important. But, and that's again, with the CIO example, brand new unions were formed from within the CIO with the support of the existing unions, but because they were new, they could form their own, they had their own new leaders. And, you know, and a lot of these, even within the whole history of the labor movement and these big strides forward, I guess, for organized labor, it was like people in their 20s and 30s who were doing this, and that's the age of a lot of, you know, the most energetic, militant, dedicated organizers right now. Absolutely. So, you know, don't feel like you got to wait till you're in your 40s or 50s to be, you know, in the right stage to be leading the charge. Like you, historically, it's people in that age range that have been the leaders of these things. So,
abso-fucking-lutely. I feel like that is a call to arms and probably a good place to leave this. But God, this has been a great conversation. Great book. Great talking with you. Great to speak with a Van Arsdale Center person again. And congrats on the book. And yeah, I hope a lot of people get to encounter it due to this episode here.
Yeah, this was a fantastic conversation. Thanks so much for having me.
Jeff, thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's Harry!